Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks so much for joining us. What kind of investment makes a real difference in the life of an underperforming child growing up in the city of Baltimore? If you take a look at the results of the nonprofit THREAD, it's clear that the answer isn't money or simply after-school tutoring. THREAD takes a much more radical approach. High school freshmen performing in the bottom quarter of their classes are matched with five volunteers who agree to do whatever it takes to help the student grow into a successful, productive adult. Everything from packing lunches and providing rides to matching students to summer internships to helping their families avoid eviction, whatever it takes. Sarah Heminger, CEO and co-founder of THREAD, is here with me to talk about the difference the nonprofit is making at three city schools, Dunbar High School, the Academy for College and Career Exploration, and Douglas High School. Sarah, welcome back to Midday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Some people haven't heard the founding story, although you brought it to Midday listeners about a year and a half ago. But can you tell us briefly how you got the idea for this?
Sure. So my very best friend in high school had gone through a number of different things. So his mom was in a really bad car accident when he was in middle school, and she became temporarily paralyzed, unable to walk. She couldn't work. She ended up losing her job. They lost their home. They moved from suburban Indianapolis to public housing, and she became very depressed and addicted to painkillers that she had been prescribed. And that spiraled out of control to her not just using drugs, but then selling drugs. So he ended up transitioning.
Your friend.
Yeah, Ryan, from what I would describe as cornfields to crack house in about an 18-month period that happened to coincide with his transition into high school. And so he failed his classes his freshman year and was going to drop out. And a group of teachers rallied around him. And instead of just saying, like, work harder, do better, they would drive to his home and bring breakfast and take him to school and make sure that the heat stayed on in the winter. They became his extended family when his family was in absolute crisis. And so fast forward a few years, many years later.
Let me put in part of the story. He, Ryan, came to the Naval Academy, came to this part of the country to attend the Naval Academy.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, while the teachers couldn't make decisions for him, he had to decide to get up and go to school. They made those decisions easier, and that absolutely translated into him becoming a straight-A student, varsity athlete, and attending the Naval Academy. And around that same time, you know, I thought, you know, when I met him, that was the journey he was on, and I thought, what an extraordinary person. And so I did everything I could to convince him to date me and eventually marry me, and so we've now been married almost 17 years.
Oh, that's wonderful. So he comes to this part of the country for the Naval Academy. You come to Johns Hopkins.
Yes.
And have a successful undergraduate career. And you're in graduate school then in biomedical engineering. And what flashes back to Ryan's experience for you then?
Well, I really struggled my first year of graduate school. I was academically struggling. I didn't have any family in the area. Most of my friends from undergrad had moved away. I was struggling to make friends at school. And around that same time, I was just driving to class the same way I would drive every morning. But I think sometimes you don't see things until you're ready to see them. And for the first time, I just noticed while I was stopped at a streetlight that, oh, there's Dunbar. There's a high school right here. And right next to the high school, there's public housing. And the thought that crossed my mind, which may seem counterintuitive, was I actually felt, not knowing anything about the school system, I don't even like kids per se, I just assumed that there were other kids in the high school that were like my husband, that were extraordinary individuals in very challenging circumstances, and I felt more capable of bonding with them than my own peers at Hopkins. And so what had really been happening in my life was I couldn't have expressed it clearly at the time, is I was just lonely. Like, I wasn't part of a community. I didn't know how to connect with others. I'm a severe introvert. And I just thought, oh, I bet this is a way I can connect. And so that was how Thread was originally founded.
It was originally a mentor. You saw it as a mentoring program.
I didn't see it as a program. I mean, I didn't even know what a 501c3 was when we started. So I had no intention of
a nonprofit.
Starting. Yeah, I had absolutely no idea that I was starting a program. What I did was I just asked the principal at the time, Roger Shaw, if he could identify students who, much like my husband, were academically struggling. And my thinking was I would just hang out with them. And it was on
not necessarily tutor them.
No.
Just kind of be with them.
No, just I didn't know what I was going to do. Like I was so lost. I was just putting one foot in front of the other. No, I had no idea what I was going to do with them. They decided that on our first day. So once Mr. Shaw gave me a group of students, we all sat down together. And the best I could do at the time was I came into the room and I said, here's three buckets of things. Academics, because I figured, you know, graduating from high school is probably a good idea. And they were struggling academically. Community service, because I think that, you know, when you are struggling, one of the best things you can do is to actually serve someone else. Mm-hmm. And then in turn helps you. And then the third bucket was team building. So how are we going to get to know each other? How are we going to actually form a team? And then I just asked them, I wrote those three things up on the board and I said, what do you want to do in these buckets? Like, you tell me. And that was our first like program design meeting.
That was in 2005.
2004. And so they came up with where they wanted to do community service for the first time. They came up with that they wanted tutoring sessions after school. They came up with that they wanted to go camping outside of Baltimore City. It was their ideas and their kind of wishes. And my role was really to try to almost administratively make the logistics happen. And that's what I did.
At Sarah Heminger, the CEO and co-founder of the nonprofit Thread, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about this nonprofit and its extraordinary results and whether it can be scaled up. I'm fascinated by the way you tell the founding story of Thread. You always, as I've heard it, include the idea that it was something that you needed as well. It wasn't just noblesse oblige, how can I help these poor struggling kids? It was connection. But in the way you've just told it now, I don't hear you mention what to me is the most amazing aspect, which is the total surround. And once a kid is in, no one is going to give up. That kid cannot get out of this program. Was that there from the get-go, or did that come to you along the way, those elements of Thread?
It came to me because it quickly became personal. So once I got to know the students, once I got to know Judy and Maurice and Daye, the idea of ever giving up on them was unthinkable. Like, it was just unthinkable. And again, like at the time, you know, now Thread makes a 10-year commitment to students. So once they're enrolled, they stay for all of high school and 6 years after. That's longer than your average marriage in this country, right?
It is.
But that wasn't the thinking in the beginning. There was no thinking in the beginning. It was just, what am I going to do today? And then really trying to pay attention and listen to what our young people were saying that they needed, they wanted, and what they wanted to give, and following that down the path. But the idea of never giving up came because it was personal. It wasn't like those kids, their kids. It was my kids, right? It was my and Ryan's kids. And
your husband Ryan was very, very, very much part of getting this going.
Absolutely.
What was his reaction to the original idea?
That I completely lost my mind. I mean, the joke in my family is that when I went to apply to college, the hardest part of my college application is that I had never volunteered before. So I had nothing to put down. So, I mean, I was like the least likely person to do something like this.
And you just said a minute ago, I thought I heard you say quickly in passing, sitting outside of Dunbar High School at the traffic light, didn't even particularly like kids. I would have assumed that whoever had started this organization that I see now would have had to have a passion about, I want to help kids. That wasn't how you saw yourself then.
No, not at all. Not even now. It's kind of like, but they're my kids, right? So it's personal, yeah, yeah. And that changes everything. That changes everything.
Let's quickly share with listeners some of the statistics. In the past decade, what kind of results has THREAD gotten?
Well, I think the thing that is most important is that we've stuck to the never giving up. So we've every student that we've ever enrolled, which is 255 students at this point, has remained in THREAD. And that has been very difficult. It's one thing for students to say, yes, I will join. But at some point, I think almost every single student says, I'm not in THREAD, I'm dropping out. And we just continue to pursue them over and over and over again. And so that's, I think, the thing that has been most impactful is just that we haven't given up on a single one of our students. 92% of them have graduated from high school. 90% have been accepted to college. And then 80% of that first cohort have a 4 or 2 year college degree or certification.
Let me make sure I understand that. When you say 80% of the first cohort, the first 4 years of, I mean, who, the
just
first cohort,
first group of
the
15
first class,
students.
The first group of 15 students.
Exactly.
80% of them have either a 2-year or 4-year degree.
Or certification, correct.
Uh-huh.
So when you think about that, so 60% of that first cohort have a 4-year college degree. That's higher than the national average, independent of various demographics. And so for them to be excelling, it just goes to show what is possible. And not just what's possible, what's happening.
And how do you pick the kids who get to be in THREAD? I mean, what's that process?
So we receive from the 3 high schools that we're at a list of students who academically rank after the first quarter of their freshman year in the bottom 25% of their class. To give you a sense of what that actually means, our first cohort, for example, at Douglas High School, the average GPA of students that were eligible was 0.15. So not 1.5, 0.15 on a 4.0 scale. Mm-hmm. 30 students in that freshman class had GPAs of 0. So once we assess where they are academically, we try to uncover what might be driving that. So we interview each of the students. And I think really important in THREAD is because the goal is a relationship, like what we're actually trying to do is create mutual enduring relationships. It's really important that from day one, we walk out that value. So for example, our students have been interviewed for so many things. They've been poked, prodded, had so many people over the years usually invade their privacy. So when we interview them, it's not an interview, it's a conversation. So for every question we ask them, they get to ask us a question. So, you know, have you ever used illegal drugs? And the student might answer, and then they'll look right back at you and say, well, have you? Right? So it's thinking about equity, not just from a systems level, but thinking about equity in a relationship. And what does that actually mean? And how do you walk that out from the very first interaction?
So do you interview a lot more students than you have place for in the program? And if so, how do you choose?
We absolutely have more students who are eligible than we can enroll. And then we just select randomly. It's very, very difficult for the staff, board members, volunteers who are part of that initial conversation because you get to know a young person and you also share about yourself. So the way that we end up selecting is just randomly. The only reason we remove a student from the pool is if there's really significant evidence that they have a strong support system already in place.
So they wouldn't really need
exactly
what THREAD has to offer.
Exactly.
That's it. We need to take a short break here. I'm sure there are lots of listeners who have questions about how THREAD works or ideas about how it might work out. Maybe you've been a volunteer with THREAD or another youth-oriented organization. What did you learn from that experience? Did you work with kids who had a similar background to you or a very different kind of background? Join the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. One student, 5 mentors, 10 years. The Baltimore-based nonprofit Thread connects 255 students and alumni to a network of more than 800 volunteers and nearly 200 collaborators. Their students come from predominantly low-income or moderately low-income neighborhoods and turn to Thread for food assistance, tutoring, college counseling. Thread also offers clothing, college visits, housing support, whatever it takes. We're talking with Sarah Heminger, CEO of Thread, and I want to pull two other strands of Thread into the conversation. Emily Rensock is a volunteer and a senior at Johns Hopkins University studying biomedical engineering. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
And Maurice Poti, an alumnus of Thread who now serves on the nonprofit's board. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Maurice, take us back to when you first came in contact with Thread. Was it called Thread then, or was it called...
No, ma'am. The proper name was IMP, Intensive Mentoring Program.
Right. And what did you think when you first heard about it, and how did you connect? What was that like?
Well, my first day coming in contact with IMP, now Thread, well, I was walking past the library one day, and I seen a few of my friends, my high school friends, inside the library with some new faces. And I seen a stack of pizza on the table. And I was wondering, man, I seen them for the last couple of days, and they've been in here and had pizza every day. So, you know, what's going on? What program is that? You know, so I pulled my friend out, and I asked him a few questions, you know, what was going on. And he gave me the name of the CEO and what the name of the program was. And I asked him, how could I get in?
Oh, so you wanted in right away?
Yeah, I wanted
because
in.
Because of the pizza, mostly.
I was a four-sport athlete, so I had to be in school anyway at the school. So I'm like, why should I be able to get into this program?
What was going on in your life then?
Then I really wasn't coming to school every day. My friends were really pushing me to come to school every day. You know, because they knew I wanted to play sports and everything, but I had a lot of things going on.
Like what?
I was orphaned when I was 12, and coming up to high school, I was really trying to make my money off the streets, doing a lot of things in the streets I'm not proud of, but a lot of things was going on at home during my early high school years.
So when you said to yourself, how can I get into this, what did you expect it to be?
Well, I really just expected, I seen that they were getting help with their homework, so I really just expected at first just to be, you know, a tutoring program.
Uh-huh.
So that was my first thought until I really got to know Sarah and really seeing how real the program was and how close they get with you, closer than your families. So then I seen that the program was just more than tutoring. It was really mentoring, like really on steroids, really.
Mentoring on steroids.
Yeah.
And Sarah said a few minutes ago that at some point every kid in it wants to get out.
Yeah, some.
What
point,
was your point when you wanted to get out, or were there multiple points?
It was plenty of points. You know, coming out of school, you know, at the school, you want to go hang out a little bit. You know, mess with the girls a little bit as a guy. You know, at the school, go play sports or do whatever. But excuse me, I need the question again.
You just did what I was curious about, whether there had been moments when you thought, I really don't want to be surrounded by volunteers like this anymore. I really don't want all this attention. I just want to go my own way.
Right. At the school, but then they run you down after school. They run you down and make sure you come to tutoring every day. So those are the only times I really wanted to get out, when I just wanted to go home and be a teenager sometimes. But they knew that the things we were getting into when we leave school were not good.
Emily Rensock, let me ask you about that point before I ask you how you got pulled into this. But that to me is one of the most challenging aspects of all this. I get high school freshmen, you make a commitment and you're making things happen, good things in their life, and that's all great. But at some point, they get to be a high school junior, they get to be a senior, they hopefully graduate from high school, they are young adults. If they want out, how do you not respect that? I really need someone to explain that aspect of Thread to me.
Mm-hmm. So I have a few students in Thread. The model we have
a bunch of volunteers working with one student, and then there are different management levels of volunteers where there is a volunteer that oversees a couple different families and a couple different students.
And you are such a yeah, manager.
So we call that a grandparent.
You're a grandparent. I'm looking at this very attractive young woman, and she's a grandparent. Okay.
Yep, I'm a 21-year-old grandma. Yeah, so pretty much all of my students have said that they've wanted out of the organization at some point. And a lot of how we handle that is just, I think, figuring out why they want out and addressing kind of the root causes of that and figuring out what the organization isn't giving them that they want, because obviously they're missing something or we're annoying them too much. But there's something, I think, that we can work with the student and figure out how we can better the relationship to make it work for both people instead of just constantly the volunteer pushing to work with the students. I think that the students also get something from working with the volunteers as well. So I think that it's important to kind of work together with the relationship and figure out what's going on. But it's a lot of like volunteers still texting the students, still calling the students, showing up at their house if they're not responding to texts. But overall, I think that most of the students find that they can get something out of THREAD and work with the volunteers.
And tell me about just those steps that you just described. Mm-hmm. Is this something that volunteers train to? I mean, do volunteers, frankly, it strikes me as human nature. If somebody's saying, I don't want you bugging me, to say, okay, fine, I'm backing off. Mm-hmm. So do you need to train volunteers to say, keep texting them, keep in their faces?
So the way that it works is we have the grandparent level volunteer, and then have a head of family volunteer. So I oversee a few different heads of families, and then they manage the volunteer group. So we have some leadership development for the grandparents and for the heads of families, and then those volunteers train the other volunteers that are working with the student. So that being said, the first time that a student does say, oh, I don't want to talk to you anymore, I can't be in this program, you do kind of step back and you're like, whoa, what am I doing? But I think THREAD encourages you to keep working towards the relationships. All relationships are difficult. It's just a matter of putting in the time and the effort to make it work.
So, Sarah Hevinger, did you, at what point did it become clear to you that you're really creating families around each of these kids? And some of them have families already. But you're creating the kind of indissoluble bond, or at least indissoluble for a decade, which, as you pointed out, is longer than many marriages last in this country.
I think it's hit me at different points in time on different levels. I think where it hit me the hardest was a few years ago. I got very sick and collapsed, and a surgery, multiple blood transfusions, and some chemo later, woke up. And I'm a very independent person. I work really hard. And it was very humbling and at times humiliating to not be able to even walk, right? Mm-hmm. I couldn't move. I couldn't do things on my own. And when I was in the worst possible moment of my life, the people who were there for me were the people in THREAD. So it was my husband. It was Maurice. It was, you know, one of our board members at the time. My husband had stayed in the hospital with me for a week, and he had to go back to work. And so one of our board members, Barbara Shapiro, said, well, you can just come live with me. And so she literally nursed me back to health for over a month. And so I think it's what's profound about the experience is that you show up over and over and over again. And sometimes, you know, Maurice didn't always want to see me, but you have these moments where, you know, I know our relationship turned a corner because over the holidays one year, this is when he was really young, but this is how I knew it was family and something fundamentally different, was he was in a situation where he ended up running from the police and he was hiding in a dumpster. And he calls me from the dumpster.
This is Maurice, who's sitting here with us. Maurice, tell us this story. Don't let her tell the story. You tell your story.
Well, I was with a couple of my cousins, and we were joyriding in a stolen car, and we went through a red light, and the police, next thing I knew, the police were behind us, and we were getting chased, high speed chase up one way hills. I was scared for my life. Let me get out of this car. Let me get out of this car alive. So we got to slow down and stop the car. Got out of the car. I'm running as fast as I can. I turn around. there's nobody behind me now. So I'm thinking, let me hide. So ended up in the trash can. I started, with my cell phone in my pocket, my jeans ripped, my hoodie's ripped. I'm thinking, who can I call, right? Didn't call any family members. Any family was not my mom, my dad, my brother. I called Sarah. And I knew where I was. I knew that I was safe at the moment. And I would call you in a couple of minutes and let you know if I made it home or not. That was the story of my 14-year-old
and
Christmas.
And so, Sarah, what did you do when you got that phone call from Maurice?
Tried to help him figure out how to get home. But, I mean, I think that's the thing. It's in the relationships, we do bicker. We argue. They're messy. They're really, really hard work. It's not like this is easy. It's really difficult. And I think it's – but you know when it's real because – we have each other's back when it really counts. So it may be, you know, an argument about whether or not you came to school or an argument about something going on in your own life, but it's when it really counts, we're there for each other.
Laurie is calling us. I'm not sure from where, but I think Laurie's been a volunteer with Thread. You probably know Laurie. Laurie, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hey, Laurie.
I can't believe, I didn't know you were going to be on, but I heard you, so I had to call. But I've been a volunteer at Thread for 2 years, and Sarah's my hero. And I came to Thread with the idea that I needed something in my life. My kids had grown and moved away, and I had that same sense of emptiness and loneliness that Sarah's talked about. And when I heard Sarah speak at a meeting, she was talking about how she was chasing some kid down an alleyway to get him to come to school. She had McDonald's in her car and was bribing him to get in the car to go to school with McDonald's. And when I heard that story, I thought, I'm joining that group.
I can vouch for that.
And I did. And it's changed my life. It's changed my whole perspective. I'm 64 years old. I grew up in Baltimore. It's changed how I look at people different from me, and I've formed relationships with students that are just, they're just the most amazing kids. These Thread students and volunteers are unbelievable people, and it's been a life changer for me.
If you had known, Laurie, if you had known how much it was going to change you, would you have had the nerve to volunteer?
That's a hard question. I don't know. I really don't know that. I went into it and I said, I'll do whatever you want. And I really didn't want to be in a family. I started out helping with communications things and helping kids with job interviews and resumes. And I was working with this one student that they assigned me to make a speech. And we developed this relationship, and she's had a very difficult life, and now I'm in her family, and there's three of us in her family, not including our grandparent, and it's not been an easy road. She's had a lot of difficulty. In fact, we hadn't heard from her for the last 3 or 4 months, and finally, one of my family members said, you know what we need to do? We need to go to her apartment and just knock on the door, and if she's not there, we need to leave her a note, and I think she'll respond. So I did that. I took an Easter basket, actually, to her, and she didn't answer, so I put a card under the door, and next thing I know, I'm at lunch with her last weekend and helping her with some of the issues she has. So,
Laurie, I appreciate you sharing your experience with us. Thank you for calling.
Okay, thanks.
So, Emily, you're a grandparent. We just talked to Laurie, who is three times your age, who is not a grandparent in this organization, apparently, but you are. We talked a bit. I talked a bit with Sarah about how kids get into this program. How do you figure out who's the right volunteer to make this kind of commitment?
Yeah, so I think that everyone kind of comes in knowing that they want to build a relationship. They want to see more of Baltimore, parts of Baltimore that they wouldn't necessarily see. But I think that all of Thread volunteers have this sort of inner drive to like make things work and build these relationships with these students. So I think that it's something that a lot of people come in kind of with an inherent want to do what Thread does. But again, like Lori said, it changes people's lives. Like Thread has changed my life as well, just coming in. My expectations for the organization when I came in and then where I'm at now are totally different.
Can you summarize what your expectation was on the way in?
Yeah, sure. So when I came in, similar to Maurice, I thought it was just a tutoring organization. I thought, oh, I'm a student at Hopkins. I'm smart. I want to see more of Baltimore. Let's tutor some kids at some high schools. So I came in thinking it was pretty much just a tutoring organization. I did a lot of what Maurice and Sarah have been talking about, chasing kids down hallways, things like that. But throughout my time in Thread, being involved in different roles and moving up to the grandparent position, I've seen that Thread really is about relationship building and just some of the interactions with my students. Like, it's not even just a one-sided relationship. One of my students, so I'm a senior, so you're trying to figure out, like, what I'm doing with my life after this. And I had last semester was trying to figure that out. And I'd taken a couple days kind of applying for jobs, not getting a couple jobs, not really knowing what I was going to do. And I was pretty worried. I was like panicking on quads, like cried a lot. And I was talking to one of my students and he was like, oh, how are you doing? And usually I'm like, oh, I'm fine. Like, school's annoying, but that's okay. But he asked, like, how are you actually doing? And I said, oh, well, I'm trying to find jobs and it's not going well and I don't know what I'm doing and I might go home to Michigan, but I really want to stay in Baltimore. And he just looked at me and he was like, well, you can't leave Baltimore. Like, I'm going to have to move with you. Like, I'm going to have to go. So that was the first time that I really realized that Thread was something that was obviously way more than just a tutoring organization. This kid is someone that I have formed a super strong bond with, strong enough where I really consider Baltimore my home now, and I have a whole new family in Baltimore because of Thread. So,
Maurice, we have to take a break here, but I just want to ask you quickly. You're an alumnus.
Yes,
you've
ma'am.
Been with Thread for like 10 years.
10 plus years.
So why are you still with it? And you're serving on the board now. What is it about it that what does it still do for you, or what do you do for it?
Because the bond that I built while I was a student inside the program, I guess the way they was helping me, and I seen that they took the time out of their lives. They were busy, you know, trying to be doctors and surgeons, and they were taking time out of their lives to help us kids that they barely even knew. So I wanted to give back. As soon as I graduated high school, I knew I wanted to give back. I knew I wanted to be a mentor because I knew that I knew some things and I can relate to these kids a lot better than half of the volunteers that come from Johns Hopkins.
And Emily is nodding to that. As I said, we need to take a quick break here. If you have a question about Thread's mission to help at-risk high schoolers, give us a call. What do you think it says about the barriers these kids face that it takes a team of volunteers a decade to push past them? If you have some thoughts on that, send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about Thread, a Baltimore nonprofit that helps at-risk high school students navigate their way from high school all the way through college into a successful life. With me in Studio A are Sarah Heminger, CEO of Thread, Emily Rensock, a volunteer, and Maurice Porti, an alumnus of the program who serves today on its board. You can be part of this conversation. What are your thoughts about what it takes to make something like this happen? Does hearing about Thread pique your interest in volunteering? Is there something holding you back from taking that first step? You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Sarah, you started, 11, 12 years ago at Dunbar High School, and then you added Ace Academy, and just a little over a year ago, you added Douglas High School, correct? And I raised Douglas High School in particular because, you know, obviously we associate that was close to where some of the rioting occurred about a year ago on the day of Freddie Gray's funeral. So I'd be curious for any of you to tell me, well, first of all, were there any Thread students particularly affected by the unrest and violence in Baltimore a year ago?
Yeah, I mean, our entire community was deeply affected, so we had physical things that happened. One of our students' homes burned down. Mm. But psychologically, I think one of the things that was challenging coming out of that is that a lot of our students felt really disappointed, frustrated, angry that a lot of help had come in from outside of the general vicinity of Sandtown. But then when the news crews were gone, a lot of that support went with them. And so there's been...
So you, let me make sure I understand correctly. You're talking about how they felt in the weeks after the riot.
Yeah, the day of was actually, it's interesting, it was kind of Thread in its normal state. So what ended up happening day of is before things had actually begun to really unfold, I was sitting in a set of back-to-back meetings, and I walk out of one of them, and Maurice had actually sent me a number of texts, and there was just text after text after text, and they were in capital letters, and it's like, get over to Douglas now. It's about to go down.
Get Maurice to tell us what you were seeing and why you felt that Thread needed to get it involved.
Yeah, so I'm a senior at Cotman State, so it's right around the corner from Douglas High School, and we're sitting in the middle of the class, and we have a TV going on in our class. We have a TV on, and CNN's on the TV. And they have Douglas High School on CNN and Mondawmin Mall. And I know that these kids go to Mondawmin every day to get home. Mm-hmm. All the kids, they go to Douglas. They all go to three different schools, end up at Mondawmin. So it's full of kids every day after school. But today up on the TV, the police up there with riot gear on. There's three helicopters going on. They let us out of school. They told us we had to go home from school.
At Coppin State.
Yeah, at Coppin. So I walk over to Douglas to see if I can find my mentee, Malcolm. Malcolm.
Uh-huh. And he's
at Douglas.
He's at Douglas. He's in what year of high school?
He's graduated now.
Okay.
He's finished. So I walk over to there. I run right into him. And I see that he's on his way over to the mall. And I tell him not to go to the mall. I pick him and his little his female friend and put them all in my car. So I start sending out text messages to everybody. Every number I have that's associated with Thread, I send everybody text messages, make sure they go to Douglas and get that student from going over to the mall and trying to get home that way, because they shut all the bus services down, shut the subway down, and they were about to start a riot at Mondawmin Mall. So I had to go get at least as many of the kids I could out of that situation.
And so that's what Sarah just described as, that's family. That's what family would do at a time when family members are at some kind of risk.
Yes,
but then you talked about the impact of April 27th as it played out.
Yes, I mean, one of the conversations we had, for the 3 days following, we kind of went dark as a community, and we just focused in on making sure that, one, we had to locate, like Maurice was saying, he mobilized hundreds of volunteers, our staff, board, to go and actually locate all of our students and make sure they were okay. And then we held kind of like camp out of our offices for a few days, where we would have conversations, we would play board games, we would do homework. We were just trying to keep everyone in the same space to make sure that, if things erupted again, no one was involved. And in those conversations, some of these frustrations came out, and someone said at one point, what if everyone who is coming in, what if they just got the phone number of one other person that they had never met before and just agreed to talk to them once a month for 30 minutes on the phone?
I'm sorry, when you say everybody who's coming in, you mean outsiders who were visiting Baltimore?
Exactly. So you had not just people from Baltimore and the surrounding areas, but people from all over the country converging in that area over, during the weeks following. And so the thinking was, well, what if instead of bringing bottled water, which is helpful, right, and was needed, what if they also just agreed to keep in contact, right? And really what was being pointed out was the power of relationships, that in the absence of that, the change can't be sustained, right? For real change to occur, we actually have to think about how do we bring our city together and form relationships that really transcend these lines of race and class. And how do we actually bring people together in a permanent way, not just when a crisis hits? And I think that's what our young people were saying to us. And that's really, I think what we walked away from those events feeling like, how do we do that at scale?
And how do you do that at scale? Because the intense relationships that Thread has created for 255 young people, how do you do that for a bigger group? How do you make that work?
Well, I think part of it is growing Thread directly. So the scale that we're actually working to grow towards is to work with 3,000 students and 7,000 volunteers.
So like 10 times the size you are now.
Exactly.
More than 10 times the size you are now.
Exactly.
Is that realistic?
We think so. A few years ago, we were offered the opportunity to expand to other cities. And during a planning process, we said, well, what's the rate limiter? And we realized the rate limiter would eventually be volunteers. So we just asked the question, well, how many volunteers can we reach? And we actually did the analysis with three different consultants three different times just to be sure. And we feel like it is actually a conservative estimate that we could reach 7,000 volunteers. And the reason that I think
7,000 volunteers at one time,
yes,
the way you currently have about 800.
Yes.
Let me ask the grandma volunteer here, Emily Rensock. Is it realistic that the Thread model could scale up?
I think it totally is. So right now we have a lot of volunteers that are based at both the Hopkins graduate schools, the med school, and then also the undergrad campus. But we're working to expand more into the community as well. And I think that that's the key into making sure that the relationships that we build are strong and that Thread can grow to scale like that. So we're bringing in people from all over the Baltimore community now. And I think that when we expand to all of these different aspects and areas of the Baltimore community, I think it'll be no problem.
Let me ask the board member, how does this look to you? I mean, you've been through this program when it was small and intense, and now you're talking about making it bigger, but still intense. And if you're on the board, you'd have some responsibility about how that unfolds. Is this realistic?
I really do think so. The way Thread has grown from the start when I first started to where it is now, if it's going at that pace, it's definitely possible.
Well, you know, I mean, family members disappoint each other as well as encourage and support. You know, families fall apart. You mentioned earlier, Sarah, marriages don't last as long as you expect these Thread relationships to last. I haven't asked you actually to tell me any failures, but I mean, there probably have been kids who were expecting breakfast and the breakfast didn't show. Or I mean, I presume stuff happens. So what is it that you envision this could be? What kind of an impact at a time when so many of us are asking and picking up on what you said a few minutes ago about people who feel that what happened around April 27th last year was, you know, a whole lot of attention on Sandtown Winchester for a few weeks and then everything has subsided. I'm not asserting that that's what I think is the right analysis, but there is a lot of concern about what the new normal is and can be. How do you see what Thread has learned being incorporated into a broader Baltimore going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about redefining what problem we're trying to solve. So just from a scientific standpoint, the study that most influences my thinking is the study that Sean Stafford did looking at the two towns of Youngstown and Allentown. And these are two towns that demographically looked very similar, race, class, religious preference. But the outcomes in terms of their economy, the crime, education were dramatically different. And when he went in and tried to understand why was Youngstown suffering and Allentown wasn't, he found a very simple answer, which was in Youngstown, the two of us, we might go to church together and we bowl together and we work at the factory together. But the difference was in Allentown, the town that was thriving, is I would bowl with Maurice. Emily and I would go to church together and we worked at the factory together. It was the diversity in the connectedness and the cross-pollination in the city that actually drove better outcomes for the city as a whole. And so when I think about like what is possible, like this has to happen. We have to form these relationships. Like without it, we aren't going to be healthy as individuals or as a city. And I think what it takes, though, so what it actually takes is not defining my success. So we have in our mission statement that we want students to mature into academically advanced, self-motivated, resilient, responsible adults. The truth is, when we've asked our young people what it is that made you change, what we hear over and over and over again is that, honestly, what made me change was I watched you and you were a hot mess and you kept falling down and getting back up and falling down and getting back up. And I noticed that you actually started making progress when you did that. And there was something to your process. And what they were really saying to us was, you were vulnerable. It wasn't just that you showed up to give me a ride to school. It's that you actually shared your life with me. You shared your challenges. You shared your joys. Like, you showed up in a real way. And so when we think about, like, what is this actually going to take? The entire reason you have a head of family is because the head of family's job is not to pay attention to the student. It's to pay attention to the volunteers. It's to know their hopes and dreams, their challenges, right? And it's to coach them. The grandparent's job is to coach the head of families. But it's about defining success in a different way. So I don't define my success as Maurice being self-motivated, responsible, and resilient. I define it as me being self-motivated, responsible, and resilient. So am I showing up consistently? Because that's within your control. You can't control someone else's behavior. But if the adults do that, the kids will be better than okay.
Okay, we're down to a minute, and since you've pointed to Maurice, I will too, and ask what of that set of skills, that set of attitudes, do you incorporate into your own life and into, I mean, you're now an alumnus, you're a volunteer as well as a board member. Is this approach of crossing the kinds of lines that so define Baltimore, is this something that's part of your life?
Yes, ma'am. Resiliency is a real big thing that I have, because I've been struggling through school, through middle school, through high school, and I never gave up. And I struggled through college now, and now I made it as a senior. I turned my GPA around from a 1.6, and now I have a 3.0. So maybe next month I maybe graduate cum laude. So I'm resilient. I've been in school for 8 years now, and Sarah always told me, like, never give up on anything that you start. And I've just been fighting, and now I'm about to come out.
Well, I wish you luck, of course, and I really hope you're right, Sarah, that Thread can be the leaven in a community that really needs it. And Emily, I appreciate your being here too. We're flat out of time. I want to thank you, Sarah Heminger, CEO of Thread. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Emily Rensek, a volunteer. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Maurice Portee, an alumnus of the program who serves today on its board. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. For listening, and thank you to the Emporium for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The Emporium is a 2-day food festival and marketplace taking place this weekend at 600 East Pratt Street in the Inner Harbor. The event showcases specialty foods as well as gourmet gifts and cooking gadgets. Ticket information available at theemporium.com. There's a Y in there, YUM.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Well, the emphasis on treatment instead of jail time for some drug offenders, we'll look at the latest thinking about what makes drug treatment effective. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.